Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
All right, Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton for another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. How are you doing, Stone?
I'm doing pretty well. Mama's home. She's off the road. She's over in Athens helping Katie move out for the semester. You know, she's headed across the pond. She's going to do the Oxford thing for next semester.
That's right. And your wife has toured the world this year.
Yes,
right?
She has. And, you know, London's her favorite city anyway. She knows every little haunt, every little bar and restaurant. And so we may have a trip or two planned for next quarter, too. So you're going to have to toe the slab a little bit more next quarter, I think.
Now, how many frequent flyer miles did she accumulate this year?
Quite some. I have no idea, but we never pay for a flight, ever, or a hotel room, for that matter.
Right, because she went to Europe several times. Mm-hmm. She was in Alaska. She was
in Alaska for a week. She was in Europe for several weeks, and that's why our marriage is so strong.
It's a good lesson there.
Absolutely. So, but you don't get to play by yourself today. I get to join in. This is going to be a fantastic segment. A little bit later in the program, we're going to hear from Harris Conter, CFP, with Raymond James. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce two gentlemen from the Wesley Company, Mr. Trevor Smith and Mr. Tom Wesley himself. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Thank you.
Well, we are delighted to have you. You guys are in the commercial real estate arena, I understand. Give us a little bit of a feel for that, if you would. Tom, what's that business all about, and what's changed recently?
Well, it's pretty much the same industry it's been for years. It deals with helping tenants and landlords with their real estate, trying to sell it, buy it, lease it. Our particular niche is a little bit different from others because we're in the area which we call tenant rep, and which means that we represent the users of the real estate and buying it or leasing it. We negotiate their contracts for them. We negotiate their renewals, their expansions, their subleases. If they own the real estate, we represent them in finding it, buying it, and if they want to dispose of it, ultimately selling it.
So now, is it the same kind of experience for a business owner leasing or buying as it is with a homeowner buying a home?
It's quite different because of the fact that obviously you're dealing with the requirements that relate to the specific use of the tenant, and in with warehouses, for example, that might be loading stack heights, the size of the trailer court. The availability of services, same thing with office space. You're dealing with probably a little more complicated these days because of the requirements for data communications, the ability to get the type of speed that you need for internet service and telecommunications.
So how far in advance, like if we decide that we need more space, that maybe we're going to do two studios and we want a real office and that kind of thing, how far in advance do we need to start planning for that and begin entertaining our options? Is that like 30 days out, or do you need more time than that?
So you guys have, you know, two rooms here, maybe 300 square feet. That question really, it depends on the size of the business, obviously. You know, so if you have, for example, 10 people, you know, and you're, you know, 2,000 square feet, something like that, you want to look minimum 4 to 5 months out. But, you know, if you have a large company, 50 people or more, you know, some companies are looking a year, year and a half, even 2 years out, they'll sign a lease. So the larger the company,
2 years out, yeah, they will sign a lease.
I had one person I talked to. They closed a 25,000 square foot lease just over 2 years out. So it's a big move. And we moved recently and almost got caught under the gun, you know, of us of all people, we should know. But yeah, we looked, you know, 5-6 months out.
So now, is it the same situation? I keep equating it to a person buying a home. Is the credit tight for businesses to move? Do they have those same issues that homeowners are finding?
The credit.
Right. Do you have to go through the same kind of hoops that you have to do when you're buying a home that you do when you're moving a business?
Yes, that is a big issue, especially when a tenant does not have a credit history. Mm-hmm. A tenant that does have credit history, they typically have financial data.
Right.
That's required by the landlord. So, and a lot of that has to do with the amount of money that the landlord's going to be spending to improve the space, the more money, obviously, the more assurance they want to have that the tenant's going to be there to pay the rent during the term of the lease.
But the crisis that we had in the homeowner's world, did that happen for the commercial real estate world as well?
Yes, and it's happened for a long time. Mm-hmm. Because in Atlanta especially, developers have always felt like it was necessary to build more product than we needed. There have only been a few times, like back during the Olympics back in 1996, where the actual demand came up to where it was close to the availability
right.
of facilities in the market. So, we've always had too much space, and still we have, at this point, close to 30% of the operating, the financing on buildings in Atlanta are non-performing at this point, according to things that we hear.
So that means that there's a lot more offices available than there is a demand for them?
A lot more office, a lot more industrial, mm-hmm. a lot more retail.
And concessions, from the tenant's perspective. Yeah. There's more concessions. It's a tenant-driven market.
So yeah. Now, so if we were looking to move and we contracted with your firm, are we paying your firm, or that happens in the transaction when we lease?
We're paid by landlords, but that's pretty much a universal commission mm-hmm. structure that it applies with virtually all the buildings in the Atlanta area and in the state.
So even if I went to a building myself without you, I would pay the same rate as if I had you watch my back?
That's correct, and we would suggest possibly more.
Really?
Because the fact that we're aware of the concessions that are being made in the market by the landlords. So we go in with a set of criteria that we want to try to do better for our customer. We want to try to do something better than what's available in the market. And we also are familiar with lease issues, the lease clauses. And it's not just the dollars that are associated with the lease. It's also the escalation provisions and the abilities to sublease and other things, which are flexibilities that, if you don't have them, will cost you a lot of money in the long term.
Right. So you don't know what you don't know kind of thing. If you
exactly.
Just... And it's
exactly.
not so much what's in the lease. It's what's not in the lease.
Exactly.
So we had one client. We address parking. It's one of our checklists we
right.
go through. And they never thought to check parking in the lease. And so they wound up parking a quarter mile away from their front door, and it was really annoying.
Well, I'll tell you, because we have a studio downtown, and it's something that we never considered, like when we have the studio, that every time you go there, it's like $6-$8 to park.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so you're saying that if you were negotiating it, you might be able to like get some included parking inside there?
Well, take Buckhead, for instance.
Right.
A lot of buildings in Buckhead charge for parking.
Right.
There are a few that are free. And
right.
A lot of our clients look just at those buildings because parking's free, and parking
right.
can be a huge expense on a company's.
Right, when you add every employee having to park.
Oh, that's got to add up in a hurry.
$50 to $100 a month per space.
We had one customer recently. We were talking about it because we have a checklist of around 46 different items that we look for in a lease contract,
mm-hmm.
and so we're looking for the things that, as Trevor says, are not addressed. And they said, well, gosh, we saw all that parking now in the front of the building, so we assumed
right.
we had
parking. We can have some of that,
well,
right?
Well, none of that was available to them. That was assigned to other people.
Uh-huh.
So that type of situation, you force the landlords to address things that they don't want you to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of of what we do. Attorneys, there are a lot of very competent real estate attorneys out in the market, mm-hmm. but they're more interested in the lease contracts than they are in deal terms. And the deal terms have got to be reflected in the contract.
And because you do this every day, you know kind of what the market's bearing and what the what really is happening there.
Exactly.
Whereas, like, if I just call up and listen to a sales guy, he's only giving me his point of view, and I don't really have that context that you guys have.
And well, in addition to that, we try to make sure that there's competition. We try to create an aura of competition. We try mm-hmm. to find options which are acceptable to you that are more than just one, so that we can create deal leverage, which
right.
will help you to get even a better transaction.
And because we've dealt with most of the landlords in Atlanta in the past, we know which ones are aggressive, we know which ones aren't.
Right.
And we can offer our opinions to our clients because they won't know that.
Right.
We can say these guys will make the deals happen quickly and they're aggressive, and these guys are just going to sit on it.
Right.
So walk me through this. Let's say that we engage you, Trevor. You sit down with us, have a conversation. Walk us through the first few steps and what unfolds over the next few months if we're seriously considering changing spaces.
Okay. So you guys are looking like you've got a good business model here. You want to grow.
Well, we don't have a hot tub. We have no pool table.
That's right.
That's why we need to add all these things in.
Right.
So we'll sit down with the client, ask them, you know, what their growth projections are. How many employees they think they need? How many are they going to be in cubicles? Are they going to be in offices? Do you want a big break room? We have a big Excel file that would break down these different rooms and calculate the actual needed square footage with about a 10% variance up and down. Because most clients will go to them and say, "Oh, we need 3,000 square feet." So, well, how did you get that number? Well, we want to hire two people. So, okay, yeah, let me show you. And generally, they'll actually wind up needing more. On the most part, so we can fit 20 people in 1,000 square feet. Yeah, it doesn't work like that.
If we're all standing up holding a strap,
anyway, right? We help them, realize what they need and the requirements, and we'll say, okay, here's where we need. Geographically, where do you want to be? You know, what kind of building do you want to be in? That sort of thing. You know, how long the lease terms? What kind of rental range are you looking for? And so I'll go back to the office and get an options report together and nice and neat and pretty and sit down with them and say, okay, which buildings do you like, you know, just from the package? And then we'll set up a tour and then we'll pick a top three and make the landlords really want us. And just so we'll do a request for proposal and just negotiate through the deal terms and then lead them on through the office space and set them up with vendors such as telecommunications and furniture and interior decorators. And so we don't just show office space. We become just the go-to of all these different vendors.
You're the guy that knows the guy.
Yes.
You're the hub. And getting all this. I'm paying less probably in the end.
Yeah, that's right. And we serve like the real estate department for the company. We do everything that a large corporation would have in a real estate department, telecommunications, moving, and we have people we've done business with, and we have a group which we refer to as preferred vendors, mm-hmm. who after we get through doing a deal, we have a question, not a questionnaire, but we meet with our customers and ask them what experiences that they have that were good for, like telecommunications, low voltage wiring, moving companies, people like that, and which experiences they had that were bad. And we record that information so that when someone's trying to make a decision, they don't have to go through an interview with 10 or 20 different people to feel like they've done a good analysis of options for things like their low voltage for their telecommunications and their data. We've already got people that we feel like we can trust, and we'll give them two or three names that they can work with so they can get bids. But again, our objective is to try to make it easy for people to have a happy experience so that they'll use us again.
Right, because a move is disruptive just by definition, you know.
Exactly.
And so you're trying to kind of provide a turnkey solution for them that when they decide to do this, that you're taking care of all the details that are involved that they may not even be aware of.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the differences between our firm and we've done the full commercial real estate thing. We've represented some of the biggest landlords in Atlanta, Georgia. But we made a decision that we could be of a better service if we represented one side of the transaction.
So you used to do both sides?
Yes, we've represented, for example, the Holder organization, mm-hmm. and their buildings they had in Atlanta for many years. And we feel like that you can't really represent two sides in a transaction. You know, you can't serve two masters.
Right.
And so we represent purely the tenant, the user. And because of that, we're never called in a situation where we have cross loyalties. The landlords like us because we bring them deals, but they also know that we're not going to leave anything on the table. And because we're not interested in getting the listing, ultimately, they know that we don't. The tenant, our client, knows that we have nothing to gain.
Right, there's no
by
agenda.
Leaving anything.
Right.
That's right. We're going to be rough. We're going to be rough on them, as rough as we need to be to get the best deal.
Yeah, exactly.
And to that point, actually, one of the listing agents or landlord agents, I was speaking with him. He said, "I actually like it when you guys come in the deal because when I have to do a direct deal, a lot of times they don't know protocol. They don't know how this whole thing works.
I'll bet.
So right. We come in, we speed this whole thing up, and we bring a chance of the deal closing, much higher percentages of closing the deal.
And faster.
Right. Exactly.
Now, there's a bunch of international, national companies here. How do you guys play with them, you know?
We are, you now, in relationship to, as customers, A good number of our clients are international firms. And, in fact, a large percentage of our companies, because those people, when they set up in the U.S., they typically have one office, and they typically set that up in a city in the United States. We hope that that's Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And because of that, and that's going to be a separate corporation than the corporation that they have in Europe. It's going to be a U.S. corporation, a subsidiary set up to do business. And so they have needs with attorneys and accountants. And they really don't know how. They don't have furniture. So we really need to help them in every element of that. We become almost the equivalent of an officer in the firm. And similarly, another large group of our clients are the companies that are the Georgia-based firms who have their headquarters here.
Somewhere, but they have, they have offices elsewhere, but they have their headquarters here.
Yeah, and we compete head-on-head with the large national and international commercial real estate companies. We don't feel that we need to make any apologies for the fact that we're a local firm. We've had customers like Allstate Insurance Company and Smith Barney and Lanier Worldwide that we've done over 200,000 square feet of transactions with each one of those companies over extended periods of time. So we can fight with the big guys. But they typically are more involved in a scenario where they're showing space and pulling together reports and having somebody else do the work. And more of our work is involved in the nuts and the bolts of getting the deal done. Because our clients don't have the depth of expertise within the organization to handle a lot of that.
Right. It sounds like your firm is more consultative and take more of a trusted advisor role rather than just a transactional, I can hand somebody a contract and look at them to make sure they signed in the right places.
So absolutely.
Most of the big firms, they'll say, okay, we got a new client, sign a listing, sign an agreement that right. you're going to work with us. We at the Wesley Company like to feel like you can fire us at any time. So we work off of a handshake, and I think at the end of the day, the client's happier, they trust us more. And we tell our clients, if you don't think we're doing 100% of our job and the best interest for you, fire us. That's it. You can't do that with the large national firms because they've got you locked down for 6 months to a year.
Right.
I mean, in the course of an 8-10 minute conversation, we've already surfaced a good half a dozen very distinct points of differentiation. It's got to give you a tremendous competitive advantage once you're out there. Where's the opportunity coming from? Is it from other trusted advisors? Is how these prospective clients get bubbled up, or you have Tom out doing all the cold calling, and then Trevor, you bring them home? Or how does that work?
Tom's a big cold caller, and myself, you got to start somewhere. So I got out of college, 100% commission, cold calling. That's what I did. But now I've found that networking for me works much better, and I don't have time to cold call anymore because I've gotten so much business through the networking.
What a great problem to have.
Yeah. But it depends on the person, I say.
Yeah. Right. But and also it must be a very nice position, but since you're the guy who knows the guy, you have this network that you're serving them, and then they want to turn around and help you back, right?
Right. A lot of our clients will send us business because they felt like we did such a good job for them.
Outstanding.
Well, if somebody wants to learn more about your firm, what's your sweet spot? You said you do a lot of international, national headquarters kind of business. What do you have a sweet spot of industry, or you'll take anybody?
We really
even radio networks.
That's funny you should ask that question, because we really feel like that we are part of a community. Mm-hmm. And there are big national firms, big international firms, and they're local companies. And we don't feel that there's we're not shy about making a large transaction and working for a big, very high credit corporation. We feel like that it's a community, and a lot of those referrals come from people who are ma and pa operations who have cousins and neighbors that are
right, and they
big
start small and get bigger. That's and right. They probably just use you all the way up the ladder.
That's right. So we don't really look down our nose at anybody. Mm-hmm. We take every opportunity we have as a gift, and try to do the best job we can with it. And I candidly believe that it makes us better servants, better capable of serving our clients, because of the fact that we are involved in so many very difficult issues with customers that don't have any credit.
Right.
And, for example, who are trying to find out a way to start a new business. Somebody deals with nothing but Fortune 500 companies, never has an experience to be exposed to that. And so they don't know how to deal with a credit issue. And those come up. They'll come up with, you know, big corporations will have subsidiaries that they do not want to guarantee. They do not have any credit. Okay? So anyway, that we think it's a real bad advantage. But again, we are not going to we want to serve people who have needs.
Right. Well, Trevor, what a gift for you to be involved in an organization like this and have this kind of knowledge base that you can tap whenever you have to.
Tom was the reason I came to Atlanta. He's a great source, a great mentor, and I learn every day, learn everything from him, and even Auburn football and how great they are. I'm an Ole Miss alum, and he gives me crap every day.
Lee, do you learn every day from me?
Yes, every day.
So our website,
yes.
www.thewesley.com. And the Wesley, obviously, Tom Wesley here. But the family has what, been around in the Atlanta commercial market for 100 years?
At least, yeah.
100 years, wow. Is that all?
Yeah, it's, wow. A little bit.
So they've seen a little bit of change.
A little bit of difference, yeah. I haven't been there for that whole time.
So, again, great mentor. I can ask him anything.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you gentlemen in the studio this morning. You got to come back sometime and keep us updated on what's going on out there.
Thank you.
It might be fun sometime to come with a client.
Yeah,
maybe get it from their
about
perspective.
How that, all work
like
together.
Walk through a case study or
sure,
something.
Sure, we'd love to.
That could be a fun conversation. You guys might be up for that?
That might be fun. Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
All right. Hey, listen, how about hanging out with us for a little bit while we visit with our next guest?
Love to. Yeah.
All right, Lee, enough of the games. We're ready for our headliner now.
Yes.
He's been waiting patiently. He's been smiling, nodding his head. He wants to move offices. He's ready to sign something, but he doesn't have to. Trevor works on a handshake. So please welcome, if you will, with Vidal. I'm going to say this wrong. Vidal and Whitley Wealth Advisors of
Perfect.
Raymond James. I do okay?
Yeah, great.
We have with us none other than CFP, Harris Conter. But I have to tell you something about him before I can officially welcome him to the show because somebody important might be listening.
That's right.
Harris Conter is a financial advisor with Raymond James and Associates, member SIPC. All the I's dotted and T's crossed?
Perfect. Compliance will be very happy.
So now we can talk, right?
Yes, absolutely.
What's going on in the world of money, man?
It's moving. That's what it tends to do. A lot of excitement there. A lot of people talking about the fiscal cliff. People still thinking about the crash of 08 and 09. And we're just working individually with client families, trying to find their unique needs and help them navigate this sea of information that's out there.
Well, I've been on the fiscal cliff since 2005. It's not news to me.
So now you recently were named 40 Under 40, is that right?
Yes, by the Atlanta Business Chronicle. It was a really awesome honor, and not surprising that both me and CeeLo Green were on the ticket.
At the same time?
Yeah, we're planning a duet album later, maybe.
So now, do you have a specialty that you work with, any type of client that you specialize in?
Yes, I specialize in working with gay and lesbian client families, and we also specialize in Home Depot executives.
Right, but and gay and lesbian Home Depot executives, they cross
that's
over
real
there?
Niche there.
That's a really sweet spot for us.
Well, I don't begrudge the professional success, but I do begrudge the under 40 bit a little bit. It's been a while for me.
So how does that even come about? Like, do you have to apply for that, or they come knocking on doors?
We have
checking
to be under
40
to start with.
I know, but they go and look at birth certificates, birth
it's,
records?
You actually do have to prove you're under 40, and despite my gray hair, that wasn't too much of an issue for me. I serve on a lot of boards around Atlanta, and I served on Atlanta's Energy Security Task Force with a gentleman named Marty Fleischman that was an alumnus of 40 Under 40, and you know, he told me, listen, Harris, I think you should really apply for this. You've done a lot of diplomacy work. You've been successful in your career. So I applied, one of 500 people that applied this year, and that list got whittled down to a top 80 and then eventually a top 40. And you submit your application, and then you kind of sit on pins and needles and wait for them to give you the call that you're a finalist.
That had to be very exciting.
It's really one of the top two highlights of my career and something that I'm very proud of.
And what was the other one?
The other one was joining Vidal and Whitley Wealth Advisors as a partner, which I joined in June. I had operated for over 6 years as a sole proprietor running my own practice and had been successful, but I knew there was more that I could deliver to clients and that as a single individual, my capacity was limited. And going from 6 years of experience in the business, even starting in 06 and going through the crash, To be part of a team that's got over 75 years of experience has really, in the short time I've been there, I've learned so much more.
So you started out thinking like you knew everything.
And then
now you're, you know, then you were a little cocky young kid, and now you got a little older and wiser, became a part of the 40 Under 40 crowd, and then you were like, I'm going to join a team. And then how has that impacted your, like, kind of day-to-day work life? Because you get kind of, when you're the boss, you get kind of used to things your way, and now you're part of a team.
It was very important that our personalities and investment styles matched. I do a lot of the strategic planning for the team.
Mm-hmm.
So I lead up a lot of our estate planning efforts and focus on some of the insurance, some of the annuities. How are we going to pass wealth from one generation to the next? How are we going to protect the wealth that's there? So it was a really good fit in the Wally Vidal and Ken Whitley, two of my partners, their investment experiences. Just spectacular. So my clients have really benefited from that piece, and the strategic element that I brought to the table, I think, has been great for their clients.
But there's two of them and one of you.
Like,
don't
true,
you
but,
lose every argument?
You know, I'm a little younger, so hopefully I can outrun them. And to be honest, we haven't really run into too many arguments, other than when we took the firm pictures, whether we wanted to do it outside or inside. but I was pretty open on that one.
Wally Vidal, is that not cognitive dissonance for you? I thought it would be something like Sergey or something like that.
Why Wally?
Wally and then Vidal, that's it? Yeah.
All right.
So it would be interesting to meet him sometime as well. So I got to ask, do you find yourself consulting with couples a lot?
Yeah, we do. You know, it's very interesting. Every time that I meet with a client or a potential client, I always tell myself, you know, don't over-anticipate what you think is going to happen, because everyone really is unique. And, you know, you can see a client family on paper and expect, you know, think what their goals and needs are going to be. But it really is unique. And we deal a lot with couples that come in. Sometimes it's individuals. It's anyone who realizes that they don't want to stare at a screen and track the stock market every day, that they need some sort of strategic guidance in that space. And, you know, it's for the same reason that I go somewhere to get my oil changed. I can't do everything myself, and I'd rather pay someone with an expertise to get it done for me.
So here's my couple's question, though. Same bed, different dreams. That, I mean, you got to be part therapist just to even, because they don't talk about money till their annual meeting or however often you get together with them, right? And they are not always coming in 100% aligned. Am I right?
You are 100% right. we have tools that we can use, and something that
so
we've
this requires tools.
Yeah, it's it requires tools, and at times it requires us to step out of the room for a minute. You know, it can be as simple as getting goals listed down. We give a set to the husband, a set to the wife, and we say, okay, you rank them. Don't worry about the other person. And then
you look at them together, and they're like complete opposite.
What normally happens is the wife gives a look to the husband and doesn't say anything, and then he looks at me expecting I don't know what. It's a very hard discussion to have, but it's an important one,
right?
And it's something that you'd rather have with someone that can help you say, okay, you know, maybe we can address both goals, or, you know, what does that goal really mean to you? Because you know, a nebulous question that gets thrown out in our industry a lot is, oh, what does money mean to you? I'll go ahead and ask you guys, what does money mean to you?
My stock answer would be freedom.
That's the number one answer we receive.
That would have been my answer, too.
But what is freedom, really?
The ability to do something like this instead of have a real job.
Okay.
Right. to do what I want when I want it.
See, now that's a lot more specific. And to do what you want when you want is maybe a number, a monthly amount that we could provide,
right,
versus the idea of freedom, which, you know, could mean skydiving or, you know, sailing off on your boat, which if you want to do those things, we can help that. But, you know, people use nebulous terms, and we can really help them drill down into specifically what's important.
Have you ever had the situation where one person's like, yeah, and when I'm at X age, I'm going to be traveling all over the world, and then the other person's like, no, I just mean, you know, I'm going to work differently. Like, I'm still going to work till I die, you know?
Knock on wood, we have not run into that. Most people that want to travel have a spouse or partner that wants to travel with them. When they want to travel alone, they tend not to bring the partner into the meeting. Yeah.
Or they have other travel partners.
Well, I bet he's like Trevor. I bet he has the go-to divorce attorney for if things get out of hand, right? Or they even rent space next door.
I'm not married yet.
Well, then he has to budget for the divorce attorney.
Right, exactly. We tend to come in post-divorce frequently.
I guess so. That's a financial event, right?
Right. Whenever there's some major event, that's probably where it's a trigger to call.
But divorce, then they don't have marriage. Any money to invest, right?
Or they
have half as much. It depends which side of the divorce they're on and how good their attorney is, I suppose.
Touché. So family businesses, and Tom, you might want to weigh in on this. That's got to present a whole different set of dynamics, the succession planning, how we're going to divide up money or how we're going to do you ever consult with family business issues?
Absolutely. My background is actually in mergers and acquisitions. I started when I came out of college working for Aaron Rents in their audit department and rose up to their lead mergers and acquisitions auditor.
Can you get me a Michael Waltrip autograph?
I can maybe get you a plush lucky dog. That's okay. it's been a while since I worked there. But we do a lot of succession planning, and it's a business for, especially in a small business, that can be a really large part of the asset base. And one thing that people tend not to think about, I mean, I come from a family of entrepreneurs, so I know a lot about family business, but that asset isn't necessarily easily monetized. It may have a value, but how do you extract actual dollars you can use from that value? And that's a lot more difficult than people think, having a paper value for your company and then converting that to actual dollars you can use.
So, Tom, am I right? Family businesses present all kinds of different issues that other businesses don't have to deal with, yeah? Is that not just financial, just the whole succession planning? That's different dynamics, isn't it?
His wife's our secretary.
That's why they call it a family business. I think that, of course, it varies as far as what your objectives are. Our business is sort of more like a partnership, and so there's not – in fact, most of the assets go home at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, assuming they can go home at that night. I mean, our assets are our people, mm-hmm. and so for that reason, especially in the commercial real estate business, you don't have a lot of equity that grows up in the company. It really comes down to your people. They leave, they take their business with you. So, with them. So anyway, it presents challenges because you want people to feel like that they belong to the company, that they're a part of it, that they have ownership in it, and that you can't really do a whole lot of financial planning with that angle. So
you know, it's interesting, Tom. We have a similar issue in our business in that obviously the financial advisor drives the business and is the largest asset in the business. And the way our team is structured, Wally and Marie Vidal, who are senior partners, a husband and wife,
sensing a theme here. Well, I'm trying to picture. You're at home. Pass the potatoes, honey. Get your own damn potatoes. You haven't sold anything in 3 months.
It's a very funny dynamic to come into. And actually, myself and Ken Whitley, the other junior partner, were hired to make sure that there was a succession plan. Wally and Marie have worked with their clients that sometimes they're in the second and third generations of working with those client families. And when they're ready to retire or at least pull back from the business somewhat, they don't want to just tell those client families, you know, we've worked with you for 30 plus years. Good luck finding someone new that understands you. So that's why they've brought Ken and I on. And over time, we'll, get to know these families and be better able to help them as they progress in their lives.
But Ken hasn't been on the radio.
No, Ken's no good.
He's way behind. Yeah. So what kind of mistakes, because you got to run into some of the same stuff over and over that just makes you roll your eyes, individuals, couples, whatever, come in and you're like, man, here we go again. I got to get this thing righted. What are some of the most common mistakes that we ought to just be avoiding?
I'll just throw out a quote, and I don't know who it is, so let's call it anonymous. When you plan to fail, when you fail to plan, you've planned to fail. So the lack of having some sort of strategic approach is the number one thing that we run into that causes problems. What we do as far as a specific money management approach is we take a very institutional approach. If you look at over the last 20, 50, and even 80 years in the industry, emotions have been the number one detractor of individual investment returns. Okay? At the bottom, everyone thinks the world is coming to an end and they're pulling their money out of the market. And at the top, everyone finds euphoria and, you know, in 2000, find someone that didn't want to buy a tech stock. And we try to put in institutional controls, and we use something called modern portfolio theory, which is far too boring to get into today, to really take some of that emotion out and put a strategic plan in place that can help the client be successful.
There really is something to this buy low, sell high strategy if people will do it, isn't it?
You know, it works very well on paper. one thing we do to actually institutionalize buy low, sell high, because it's the easiest concept to understand and the hardest to implement, because nobody wants to buy low. What we do is something called rebalancing. So to make a real easy example, let's say you have a portfolio half stocks, half bonds. Well, we'll go 40% stocks, 40% bonds, 20% real estate, since we have some commercial real estate guest here.
Horrible investment.
A few years goes by and your stocks and real estate goes up and your bonds go down. Well, most people will just let that ride. Oh, it's doing well. Let's keep doing it. Instead, at a periodic interval, we go back to our original allocation. So we'll trim the excess off the stocks and off the real estate, put it back into the bonds. If the bonds grow, it usually means the stocks are going down. So we'll trim the top off the bonds and put it into stocks. And over time, you get an institutionalized buy low, sell high that, you know, as you stretch over 5, 10, 20 years, adds huge returns to your portfolio.
Now, what are huge returns?
2-3%.
Now, when you're dealing with clients, do you deal with a lot of clients that maybe have tried to do this on their own? You know, they watch these commercials that say, like, even a baby can do this kind of thing, and then they realize maybe the baby can't really do those things, and they better call and get some help. It's like cutting your own hair. It sounds like it looks easy, but maybe it's harder in real life.
You know, I tell my clients all the time that investing is really not as hard as we like to make it seem. And that, you know, after working with us for a little bit, you would be capable of doing this on your own. And I really firmly believe that investing isn't as difficult as often people in my industry would like to make it seem. But it is exceptionally time consuming. And if you have a full-time job, you probably don't have time to fully strategize on how to invest your own assets. So for us, when we bring clients on, it's important, you know, not just, you know, what they have in the bank, but what type of people are they? You know, are they the type of people that want to work with an advisor? You know, do they like strategic advice, or, you know, are they the do-it-yourself types? Generally speaking, do-it-yourself type of investors, sometimes they start working with us and really like it, and sometimes they say, you know what, I love the control. I want to, you know, always be driving the ship. And we do work with those clients, and we give them options. You know, we like option A, B, and C, and this is how we think they'll perform. And then the client can still drive the ship. But it's really a mix and a diverse group of who walks in the door.
How do you get started in this business? Because I can see after you've been at it a while, you've got a reputation, you get referrals and all that. But how do you just walk up to somebody and start managing their money, particularly people that have money? That's got to be tough.
Yeah, after you run out of relatives.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's right. Funny. That's you always start with friends and family, and better to take the lumps with them. You know, it's funny. I look back sometimes and I wonder, how did I get here? Mm-hmm. I was doing M&A work, and I got really tired of being the big company pushing out the little mom and pops. And my team was the ones that said, I know you thought you were going to get X on this deal, but you're really going to get Y because of A, B, and C. And you know, I didn't negotiate the deal. I didn't write the contract. I'm just executing it. So I decided, you know what, I want to be working more with individuals, less with kind of the big behemoths. And someone recommended financial services. This was back in 06. And I said, you know what, if this doesn't work out, I'll just run back to the corporate world. And then you just get started, get out in the community. You know, at the very beginning of my career, I made cold calls too. And you just start working and talking with people. And anytime you can open up a dialogue about finances and we have a 3-meeting process, and in the first meeting, most clients are surprised how little we talk about finances, investment. We really want to get to know you as a person. What's important to you? You know, do you donate to charity regularly? We can help you establish a foundation. It's not all about we got 8% return this year, 12% return the next. So we really try to dig into the individual and find out what's important to them. And then before you know it, you're 5 years in and you can't get out.
Now, if somebody wants to learn more, you have a website?
Absolutely, we do. You can visit us at www.vidalandwhitleywealthadvisors.com. I'll spell that because it's pretty cumbersome. www.vidalandwhitleywealthadvisors.com.
Simple.
Simple. Piece of cake.
All right. Well, thank you for being part of the show. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next week on Atlanta Business Radio.